Hey there, it's Michelle Norris. I'm host of a podcast called Your Mama's Kitchen. When I travel, I'm usually looking for a way to find a taste of home when I'm not at home. And one of the things I love to do when I am at home is entertain. And Airbnb allows me to do that. When I was in California recently, I rented a house that had a great kitchen. And when we were sitting around the table, we're all thinking, we're in someone else's house. Someone could be in all of our homes as well. If you have a home, but you're not always at home, you have an Airbnb. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
A lot can happen in a year. Trends, debuts, world-altering events, and pop culture and film is there to reflect it all back to us generations down the line. Welcome to the A Year in Film podcast, presented by Hollywood Suite. I'm your host, Becky Shrimpton, and today I'm joined by curator and film historian Alicia Fletcher and Toronto-based critic, lecturer, and instructor at U of T, author of several cinema books and articles for publications like The Ringer and CinemaScope, Adam Naiman. What drives the desire for man to go to space? Is it the exploration of the final frontier, the urge to know more about ourselves and where we came from? Or is it just straight capitalist desire to strip mine everything for profit? 2000 saw several movies that were about space colonization and exploration, specifically focusing around Mars. We're going to look at two of them today, but Adam, before we do that, do you have a guess or do you know why there were so many movies about this topic?
Well, my math tells me that 2000 was the first year of a new millennium.
And, your math is correct. Yeah. It checks.
And also my math tells me it's 1 year off from the rather mythical or film mythical year of 2001, the year dramatized, prophesied, and sort of seen somewhat presciently by Stanley Kubrick in 1968 with 2001, which is very much a movie against which all sci-fi exploration movies measure themselves against, whether it's in terms of narrative or theme or special effects. And I think by 2000, 2001, the idea of 2001 had caught up to itself, right? I think special effects had been made even more and more central to American movie making, which is one thing that 2001 contributed to, but Star Wars very much pushed over the top. And I think that maybe, I'm just spitballing here, the acceleration of both space technology, film special effects technology, and an absence of that old-fashioned heroism that was associated with space travel, space exploration, the space race, America asserting, you know, its dominance through the spheres. Those things all kind of caught up to themselves. Now, that's balanced against the fact that it's often hugely coincidental when movies on similar subjects and themes end up being theatrically released at the same time. So we could go down a rabbit hole of why those seven movies all came out within a year and a half of each other. Or we could sort of say, wow, that's cool that that happened. But there's no question that in 2000, your film cultural, your editors, your writers, early internet film culture did the same thing they did when Deep Impact and Armageddon came out in 98. Right. They're like, what is it? What does it mean? And you could argue that what does it mean is the theme of 2001 and Mission to Mars, as well as the only relevant question to ask about Red Planet. What? What the fuck does that mean?
Oh, I have a lot more questions about Red Planet than just that, involving the pissing contest between Tom Sizemore and Val Kilmer that actually happens on film. That's not a metaphor. They actually try to see whose stream will go highest while on Mars'
Those
atmosphere.
Those are all Val Kilmer movies from, like, what, 19, maybe 88 onwards? Every single film has an interesting story about who he had conflict with and how it went down.
Well, now, as we're recording this, there's a film documenting Kilmer's career. Premiering at the Cannes Film Festival called Val, which is him filming himself over a period of 30 years, which I just think sounds amazing. I have not read enough about the film to know if there's like a long section on Red Planet, but it seems but it seems possible. I'm sure he was taking video diaries of himself at that point.
I did check, and I think sadly this gets left out, and I almost do wonder about rights issues and things like that with a documentary like that. It's the same director as Won't You Be My Neighbor, Doc. So, I mean, this is a very practiced person in getting around rights issues. But I do think of some of these big studio titles, especially titles that studios want to bury, I do wonder about that back door. If they were like, mm-mm, you can do whatever, you can do all the Dr. Moreau you want, but you can't do Red Planet.
But I do think it's interesting that we're dealing with two movies about missions that for various reasons malfunction due to kind of industrial and mechanical, but also human error. And these are also both productions that in different ways had issues, right? We can say about Mission to Mars and Red Planet, whatever you think of the finished product, they are not, neither of them are quite the movie that was intended to be made, which is a kind of interesting dovetail between theme and production circumstance.
We're going to get into that as well. And the, I mean, the big thing too, as well, that a lot of people forget is like the year 2000 is when people got really interested in space and mining rights once again about who things would be owned by and colonization. So 2000 is actually the year where we figured out there may or may not be water on Mars. That's when we found those channels. And that's also 1997 is when the first Mars rover land, the Mars Pathfinder rover landed and started taking high definition pictures so we could actually see what was going on. Do you know who can own planets? Do you know what like the international agreement on this is?
I'm guessing Amazon has their hand in it somehow.
No one. According to the United Nations, no nation can stake a claim regardless of whether or not they plant a flag on it. But there is a guy named Dennis Hope who wrote a letter to them in 1988 citing a flaw that he saw where he was like, well, no nation can own one, but what about an individual? And he never heard back, so he just staked a claim on it and then started selling shares of the moon. He has sold 611 million acres so far of land on the moon, each at $19.95, $36.50 after a lunar tax and shipping and handling of the deed. He has also claimed ownership of any of the planets that have land masses, not gas planets. So Mercury, Mars, Venus, Jupiter's moon, Io, and Pluto. You can buy the entirety of Pluto for $250,000. Just so you know.
But Pluto got downgraded. I mean, you buy that for $250,000 and then you find out it's not a planet and it's like buying a studio condo. You're screwed.
I am the owner of multiple children's books with variations on titles like Pluto, the sad planet that isn't a planet, or What Happened to Pluto, which are all these anthropomorphic Pluto talking to the other planets who kind of bully him or her, depending on how it's written. But your moon saga reminds me that there's a Canadian documentary called Lunarcy by Simon Ennis that talks a little
That's
bit.
That's who this is about.
Yeah, that talks about that stuff, as well as various other ideas about moon travel and the mythologies of the moon. For sure.
Well, we're going to be getting into a lot of colonization stuff today. And in my opinion, these are both movies about capitalism gone horribly awry in both cases. And just humans are expendable in order for us to create new homes from planets we have ruined. So our first movie today was described by Ebert as a film where much of the suspense involves the disappearance of algae. And as you can possibly imagine, it takes a philosophical approach to Mars exploration, launching Val Kilmer as part of a space crew to contemplate the greater meaning of the universe and God as they embark on a heroic mission to help colonize Mars in the face of a dying Earth. But lest you think this is a movie that's all pontificating Terrence Stamp, someone will be brutally torn to shreds by a glorified GPS robo-dog named Amy, someone else will be tossed off a cliff for some reason, and you bet Tom Sizemore and Val Kilmer will have words, both in character and on set. Will Carrie Ann Moss save them all? Should she bother? Let's talk Red Planet. Alicia, I gave like a little bit of an idea, but like, what's this one about?
Oh my God. So they've terraformed Mars because it's 2053. And basically by 2020, keeping in mind that this film is from 2000, we've destroyed the planet. So right there, we're accurate. We're right on target. So by 2052-53, they know that they have to terraform Mars in order to transplant the human race, I guess. It's not really explicitly said. However, a successful algae campaign where they're growing algae on Mars goes awry and the algae all dies. And so they send these, for lack of a better term, space truckers, although these aren't like the kind of space truckers from Alien. They send this crew to go and investigate what's happened. Yes, they have a robo dog. Its name is Amy. It's kind of like the robo Cujo of the film. So this film doesn't really know if like, is Mars terrifying? Are humans terrifying? Or is this robot dog that's basically the Terminator that then gets like a switch kind of flicked on it and when it lands improperly and then tries to kill the whole crew while they're on Mars trying to survive. It doesn't really know what it is. It has elements of sort of everything you could picture a various Martian film being. There are characters that are dispensed with quite quickly. I was very sad for Benjamin Bratt, who is in this film and has really worked on, really worked hard on his arms that he's killed very early. Like his, these are like, this is like a ripped Benjamin Bratt. It's insane. Terrence Stamp is in this film and he is like done away with, I think, at the 30-minute mark. And I don't think
that's
a spoiler.
They give him a monologue and you know that's why he's there. It's just he got a great monologue about the nature of space and God. And then he's like, hey, I'm great. Send the check over to my agent. See you later.
I realized science couldn't answer any of the really interesting questions. So I turned to philosophy. Been searching for God ever since. Who knows? I may pick up a rock and it'll say underneath, made by God. The universe is full of surprises.
That would be a big one.
Yeah, he's really misused. I mean, it does allow for Val Kilmer at the 30-minute mark in this film to use the line, you know, we're not going to leave you behind, or, you know, no one gets left behind. And then he bleeds out in his spacesuit. It is a lot about algae. There is an alien life form that is not revealed until the third act, which I think this film could have been improved by if that element, which, and I want our listeners to keep in mind that Pitch Black is also the year 2000. There are elements of Pitch Black in this film for sure. If they'd brought in the sort of like scary alien bug that burrows into your brain and, you know, kills you much earlier, I think it would have been a more effective horror film. But basically, yeah, they have to figure out what happened to some algae while Val Kilmer and Tom Sizemore are buddies in the film, but you can really tell we're not buddies on set. And you can even notice that, I think at a certain point, it could be wrong, they're probably refusing to be on set together because anytime they have a conversation, it's either a body double or it's filmed over someone's shoulder.
That's exactly what happened. Right. It got to the point where they refused to be on set with each other. And if people are familiar with what happened with Marlon Brando and Val Kilmer on the set of Island Dr. Moreau, something very similar happened here where the dick swinging happened very early. And apparently Tom Sizemore and Val Kilmer were actually buddies for a long time, even before this film. And then Val Kilmer found out that Tom Sizemore got some of his specialty workout equipment shipped in from Europe, and that didn't sit well with him. And so that's when he started refusing to come out of his trailer until he got the same special treatment. And then they started swearing at each other. And at one point, apparently, they started throwing weights at each other in the weight room. And when this Tom Sizemore character went to hit the Val Kilmer character, was supposed to do that, the ADs had to yell, not the face, not the face. We're not done shooting close-ups yet. So he punches him in the chest. And that's him actually hitting him. So they stopped talking for a while. But according to Tom Sizemore, they're good now.
I mean, it's just heartbreaking to see, you know, cast members from Heat fighting. the whole point of that movie, as I recall, is that, you know, it's family. No, actually, that's the point of the Fast.
I was just going to say, you're getting Fast
and Furious.
I think the point of Heat, though, is that you've got to get along in a professional environment. And I think that Kilmer in that film is a bit of a liability, but he went full Wayne Grove in the mid to late 90s in his other movies. He's the guy, there's like this elephant graveyard of Hollywood films from the mid to late 90s that are marked by Kilmer.
Yeah.
And it's offset by the fact that he's an amazing actor and screen presence. So it's not about separating the art from the artist in that case, to use a really dumb phrase. It's sort of more like that quality that Kilmer has always had of just being magnetic and fascinating and weird. And he stands out in very normal conventional movies. He has an interesting vibe. Mm-hmm. You know, that interesting vibe doesn't come out of nowhere. But here, it's not like the movie is giving him anything particularly interesting to play. And while I can't speak for Tom Sizemore, or I guess I can't speak for Val Kilmer, what you get from Kilmer in this movie is he's bored.
Yeah.
You know, this is like the epitome of a bored performance, because it's not a movie-wrecking performance or a movie-wrecking behind-the-scenes thing where it results in a fascinating bit of acting. He is just completely narcotized for this entire movie. He's barely Kilmerish.
It's hard to describe how he looks on this film, because he has these frosted tips. He's this really weird blonde, and he's kind of a Point Break surfer dude.
But so does Gary Sinise. So this is obviously the sign of the frosted tip tips. We're going to get into Dracula 2000 coming up and that whole 2000s aesthetic.
Yeah. And he's, you know, he's got like the sort of surfer necklace. He is the romantic lead sort of in this very misguided romantic subplot that's in Red Planet. We haven't even mentioned Carrie Ann Moss, I think, is quite good in this, or she's trying at least. And she she's never on, she never gets to Mars. She's always on the ship that's malfunctioned and sort of, the voice of their god, the person who's going to be responsible for potentially saving these stranded Martian astronauts. That romantic subplot just doesn't work. It's baffling. Like, I can't imagine anyone, this is a Warner Brothers film, I can't imagine any studio executive allowing this out of the can.
Get up early because the first scene between Kilmer and Carrie Moss, he like surprises her coming out of the shower. And she's like kind of okay with it. She's, you know, doing stuff with a towel and he's kind of looking at it. And you're like, okay, these guys have been in space for a long time. It's interesting to see these feelings kind of developing.
Just pretend I'm your sister.
I have two sisters. They don't look like you.
But yeah, she's completely sidelined. And it made me think when you're talking about she never gets to touch down. I mean, they keep calling her like mom, right? And I thought about how in Alien, the whole joke was on the idea of this maternal artificial intelligence called Mother, or that in 2001, the sort of homoerotic undertones of how like it's all playing with that idea of gender and masculinity and femininity and technology. But I mean, here the filmmakers are just so unimaginative. They're like, we'll take this really attractive, talented actress coming off the Matrix and just sit her in a chair.
Yeah.
While everybody kind of goes down there. It's not a comment and it's not subversive and it's not satirical. It's just such a waste because she might actually have some dynamism if she was down on the surface doing stuff with people.
She's good. Like, her monologues are good. She looks incredible. Like, if Benjamin Bratt has amazing arms, like Carrie Ann Moss's arms are stunning. They're like a
but
sculpture.
She's also coming off Matrix, and there was an actual physical gamut test that they had to do to be even cast in the Matrix to be able to do any of that wire work, and she's coming right off that, so she was ready to go. And she's the one who actually gets the most interesting action sequences in this film. I do want to bring us to the first-time filmmaker who helmed this mess, named Anthony Hoffman. Now, Anthony Hoffman is a commercial director who the producers saw his work and went, oh, he can probably handle some big imagery. He's clearly very intelligent. He was handling really high-end brands. I believe he did something for like Givenchy and things like that. So he was doing very artistic, beautiful things. And then he was handed $80 million to make this first feature. And he really took it seriously. He went and he visited NASA and he watched them work and he tried to genuinely figure out what would fire look like in space. And that's something I really did appreciate about this like genuine attempt at authenticity. But then you also give him this script and you give him Val Kilmer. And anyone, as we have seen, handing them Val Kilmer with any other sort of male lead for their first film is just a recipe for disaster. And reading interviews with him at the time, he was like, no, nothing went down. All the sayings that he was going nuts were totally exaggerated. There was no drama on set. So it's really interesting that he kind of took this approach for his first film, kind of trying to salvage it. But he didn't step foot on another film set up until now. It looks like he's got something else in pre-production for 2022, but he didn't get another film after this point.
It bombed. I mean, this is a film that, it's an $80 million budget, which it's very rare for a major studio to give a first-time director a budget like that, or to have a film budgeted at this and then go for someone who is so untested. And it ended up worldwide only making $33 million. I think in its first weekend, it made like $3 million, something that's just like, wow, like almost staggering that I can't imagine this film even doing that poorly, because at least it had a trailer where you could tell it was special effects and recognizable faces. Somehow people were able to figure out that this was quite stinky, unfortunately.
This came out before Mission to Mars, I believe. And do you think that would have affected the box office of Mission to Mars if this one did no bueno?
I don't know. What do you think, Adam?
I mean, maybe in very different ways, neither of these, despite the good bet vibe that they had by being these millennial Kubrickian, you know, Mars and the Zeitgeist movies, I think they were both kind of bad bets. Mm-hmm. And hindsight's 20/20. But when you look at what was, I mean, again, this is the sort of thing that it's a little facile to do. But I mean, what's the huge hit of 2000 is Gladiator, which is a kind of throwback, movie. It's a very digital movie, but in the service of kind of analog textures. I mean, you can play that game and it's a bit of a rigged game, but you can sort of be like, well, that obviously just wasn't kind of what people wanted to see at that moment. I think both studios bet big. And made the kind of made the kind of big bet that when it doesn't pay off, you just get absolutely dunked, you know, because you can't do science fiction cheap.
I was going to say, like, I think hard science fiction is a tough sell, and these were sold as hard science fiction. Like, yes, they had action, but in their marketing materials, they're talking about how Anthony Hoffman is going to NASA, and I think that would have scared people off, because something like Pitch Black does very well and launches the career of Vin Diesel, like, in the same year.
But what's interesting, too, is that Red Planet is closer to Pitch Black in that it has its trashy side, mm-hmm. like the killer dog CPU thing and whatever else. But I mean, Pitch Black does lean into B-movie stuff in the way that Mission to Mars definitely doesn't, and in the way that I think Red Planet does without any sense of purpose. When Alicia was describing the film earlier, I thought really well, something you were saying, all this stuff keeps happening. It's like a movie that is trying to find things to happen. Instead mm-hmm. of any of these things developing really organically out of the situation, none of these things develop out of the characters. None of these things develop out of the performances. The movie just keeps throwing stuff at people to kind of see how they deal with it. And then it's just the law of movie star survival, which is the higher build somebody is, the longer they kind of last, which takes all the pleasure out of that kind of, and then there were none.
Yeah.
Setup. I mean, even Mission to Mars, which we'll get to later, plays with that very interestingly from the moment it says, and Tim Robbins. You're like, oh, that's interesting.
Oh, he's going to explode in space for sure.
We're going to do something with that. But, there's just no there's no spontaneity in Red Planet. And rewatching it the other night to prepare for this, I was hard pressed to think of a movie that so feels like a slog like this does by the end, where you are just like, get somewhere. Get to the end of the planet, get to the thing you're finding, get off the planet. I need this to stop.
I watched on an airplane. It was my first big flight in the kind of, post third wave COVID era. Watched on an airplane, which is a really strange experience. And yeah, it was just like my flight felt so long, longer than it should have, flying from British Columbia to Toronto because I was watching Red Planet.
Well, let's get into this idea of hard sci-fi being a hard sell. How much authenticity do you think the average viewer actually wants to see? Because you think of something where like it's just now the everyday life of these truckers in space, like Alien, versus, I mean, even 2001 A Space Odyssey makes it kind of this is the everyday life of these people until it gets weird and goes off the rails. This is going for that level, but there's still like you almost feel like you're on Earth the entire time. Like they don't ever deal really with like a lot of gravity or anything like this. This is dealing with like the actual physics and what would happen if you were in the situation. And then when it goes out of the reality is when it becomes weird and you can't follow the logic anymore.
Yeah,
what do
yeah.
you think?
I mean, so there's a Roger Ebert review that you've already kind of mentioned. But one of the things he kind of talks about is there, this could have been a great 1950s sci-fi because 1950s sci-fi doesn't care about psychology or characters. It's just about brainy scientists trying to get themselves get the Earth out of this box that is growing smaller and smaller every minute. And in that way, Red Planet does that because you do have these great scenes that were heavily, I guess, researched and kind of authentically presented of what fire would look like in zero gravity. It's one of Carrie Ann Moss's best action sequences. But who cares? It's 2000. Like, this isn't War of the Worlds from 1953. This isn't the day the Earth stood still. Who cares? I don't care in 2021, and I definitely wouldn't have cared about that level in 2000. You need the characters to support hard science fiction, and Red Planet doesn't have it. And I think I'll be curious to see what you and Adam think about Mission to Mars, because it's a very different film.
When you're mentioning War of the Worlds or Day the Earth Stood Still, my ears perk up because also what those movies have in them in different ways, the old George Powell War of the Worlds, but certainly Day the Earth Stood Still, is they convey the largeness and the stakes of what's going on through some kind of an emotional attachment or some kind of an emotional display by the characters. So the Day the Earth Stood Still is interesting. You've got this impassive, kind of boring, in a way, very stolid alien protagonist played by Michael Rennie. You've got this big robot Gort. It's all somewhat campy, but it's conveyed at the end of the film that the exposition is like, if we are not careful, you in the audience, with our reliance on technology and our competitiveness on Earth, we're going to sort of, destroy ourselves. It arrives at that moment of revelation. Red Planet front loads the exposition so badly. Mm-hmm. In those first 5 minutes, it's like everything's gone to shit. We have no chance for anything because we're telling you, not showing you.
It's a voiceover. It's really bad. It's one of the worst voiceovers I've ever seen in a film.
And it's where you can tell that either the director isn't sure or the director wasn't sure, so they forced the voiceover in to give this kind of narrative coherence. We'll get to Mission to Mars in a second, but in the first 10 seconds of Mission to Mars, you know everything you need to know about the visual, emotional, somewhat satirical language of this movie, because it's made by a great filmmaker. The first shot of Mission to Mars is great. There is no first shot of Red Planet. I guess there's a first shot in the movie, but there's no visual announcement. There's no language. There's no honing in on a character. There's just a bunch of people are going here because we say so.
Yeah.
And it never clarifies, simplifies, or focuses in a way of not just great 50s sci-fi, but of decent sci-fi from any era. Think about Alien, which Alicia brought up. That movie is unbelievably interesting even before the alien arrives, even before it shows its horror movie hand. You know, I love the first 20 minutes of that movie. I could watch 2 hours of the boring space trucking.
Yeah, and I think also to your point about the 50s sci-fi and to Alien and subsequently Aliens, the production design is there. There's even if you're not a science fiction nerd, and these films appeal to far beyond sci-fi nerds, the production design is there. There's heart, there's thought, there's, you know, follow through, and none of that is there in Red Planet. The production design is they really focus on authenticity, and you have that sort of International Space Station. And I do love that the Mars rovers make a cameo. Like the ones that people would recognize from the news headlines have a cameo in a film set in the 2050s, but it's not there. It doesn't look.
And I'm gonna be really unfair and invoke 2001 again. The thing about HAL is that it's scary because it's not embodied.
Yeah.
Right? It's like, this is scary. It can't move. It's just a panel. You know, in Red Planet, they try and have it both ways. You try and have this idea of CGI run amok because, as Alicia says, it gets set to evil, like the Krusty Doll from The Simpsons. It reminds me of The Emperor's New Groove. They say, why do we have that lever? It's like, why do you have the evil switch on your GPS? Just don't build it that way. I hate that kind of CinemaSins way of reviewing movies. Like, I hate talking about plot inconsistencies as reasons movies are bad, but it's really stupid.
Yeah.
It like really stupid. But then when it becomes this like agile, you know, robot monster Terminator thing, it's not scary, because then it's not about ideas being scary. It's just this thing that just won't stop chasing people, and it happens
to be on Mars, and it just happens to be on Mars, and nothing else matters.
So I think there's a lot of ways to fix this film, because as I think we've kind of established, it doesn't know exactly what it is. So it's just throwing everything to the wall. And that might be the case of the original script just being not knowing what it was. Or this might be the case of a director who just didn't know how to play on this scale. And I think about the idea that, like, okay, you're just randomly now throwing a guy off a cliff. That was the part that made me go, sorry, what? The most is when Benjamin Breck gets tossed off a cliff. Simon Baker? Simon Baker tosses him off a cliff for no apparent reason.
Well, no, he called him a name. He called him a mean name.
I came up here to forgive you.
Yeah? Well, screw you.
I don't need forgiveness from a pussy like you.
And then he tossed him over. So then I started thinking about, like, that if you're going authentic, they do a lot of psychological tests on astronauts, Why are you sending obvious homicidal maniacs who snap that quickly out into space, even when they've been under, like, just certain things just don't make any sense about why the stakes are now happening to these characters.
Yeah. And again, the characters we are left with in the end, it would be far more compelling to have just shot a documentary of Val Kilmer and Tom Sizemore preparing for scenes than the kind of weird waiting for Godot Martian wandering thing you get with these two actors. The movie eventually boils down to kind of the two of them going through the final stages of the Mars decathlon, you know, and just considering maybe it's because they hated each other, their hearts weren't in it, or just, you know, the movie isn't particularly well edited or made at any point, but it really dies when you're down to, and then there were two, and then there was one, which is when a movie should start cooking, you know? That's when you want, and that's something that a movie like The Martian, which I don't even really like, it does have the irresistible hook of a character's loneliness and isolation, and you have Matt Damon playing against the situation, and Matt Damon is better playing against the situation and to the audience and the movie lets him be, I guess it's a differently written movie, then these guys are playing off of each other. Like, there's the inevitable moment in this where one of them is kind of like, not just the bit with Terrence Stamp where it's like, don't leave me behind, and then he dies, but there's the inevitable moment with Kilmer and Sizemore, like, one guy's got to kind of let the other guy go, and you get the self-sacrificial gesture, and I'm sitting on my couch being like, I know it's not totally the movie's fault because I'm dead inside now, but I feel nothing.
You're telling me when Tom Sizemore kamikazes himself, you don't, or commits harikiri to save Val Kilmer, you felt nothing? Of course not.
From little parasites. But at the very end of the movie, the Earth might just be saved. We might not need to terraform Mars. That's the entire point, we have found some sort of deus ex machina. Yeah, because the little creatures are what cause the Earth to be able to breathe, except for they like to burrow inside you. They restore the atmosphere. That's the whole point of this thing. And now they managed to get them back to the space station where Carrie Ann Moss can now deconstruct them and save the planet.
Well, this is definitely a film that's not aware of what happens when you take a xenomorph off of the planet in order to save your current planet, because we've seen that happen in Alien, Aliens, Alien 3, and Alien Resurrection. It's a bad idea.
All right. Well, I think that's probably the place where we should move into our next film, because I think we have nicer things to say about Mission to Mars. We're all De Palma fans here, it seems like. All right. So when we come back, it's Mission to Mars.
Wow.
Nice.
Yeah.
What you're hearing are the sounds of people everywhere putting on Bombas socks, underwear, and T-shirts made from absurdly soft materials that feel like plush clouds. Yeah, that plush. And the best part? For every item you purchase, Bombas donates another to someone facing homelessness.
Bombas. Big comfort for everyone. Go to bombas.com/ACAST and use code ACAST for 20% off your first purchase. That's bombas.com/ACAST, code ACAST.
Hiring for your small business? If you're not looking for professionals on LinkedIn, you're looking in the wrong place. That's like looking for your car keys in a fish tank. LinkedIn helps you hire professionals you can't find anywhere else, even those who aren't actively searching for a new job but might be open to the perfect role. In a given month, over 70% of LinkedIn users don't even visit other leading job sites. So start looking in the right place. With LinkedIn, you can hire professionals like a professional. Post your free job on linkedin.com/people today.
Brian De Palma isn't the first person who would come to mind when you think, let's hand off a big budget ensemble thriller to. But a lot of people forget that he helmed the first exponentially successful Mission Impossible movie. And although Mission to Mars wasn't his very next movie, we're going to jump over the bizarre but candidate for this podcast, Snake Eyes, it makes sense that he'd be chosen for Apollo 13 meets the Abyss. And hey, it even has Gary Sinise in it. It would, however, be De Palma's last studio film. And if the title sounds familiar to you, just know that this is a movie made by Disney based on one of its rides, tangentially. But we're going to get into that. So, Adam, what's the basic plot of Mission to Mars?
Mission to Mars is set in 2020. And I noticed that dateline when I was watching it last night, going like,
13 months actually makes it July 2021.
July 2021. Mm-hmm. That's what
they
I was
land
say
on that. July 2020. Sorry, yeah. I interrupted you.
No, it's happening right now.
Yeah.
Somewhere in space, they're listening to Van Halen's "Dance the Night Away" in real time. No, it's interesting. It's about a group of like NASA pals or space pals. There's this real camaraderie between these three guys: Gary Sinise, Don Cheadle, and Tim Robbins, which is a pretty good trio. I would watch a remake of Husbands with those guys. I would watch a remake of The Three Musketeers with those guys. Gary Sinise wanted once upon a time to go to space, and for reasons pertaining to just life and the death of his similarly space questing partner, played in flashbacks by Kim Delaney, he's no longer going to go. Don Cheadle wants to go to space and picks the emotionally terroristic thing of reading his kid Treasure Island right when he's about to go. And it's like, hey, son, I know I got to go. Let's each read Treasure Island separately from each other. Like, Dad, could you maybe not pick something about someone getting lost in an island? I'm going to have nightmares. And then Tim Robbins, who, like Sinise, has this beautiful life space partner who has not died. And it's hard for Gary Sinise to see this because he also was part of a space couple. His lady died. And Tim Robbins' lady, Connie Nielsen, is alive and well. So Cheadle goes into space with his own crew. They go to Mars. They think they find something. They broadcast their findings back to Earth with a 20-minute delay. So at the exact moment that all the people on Earth are like, cool, they found something, they are actually getting ripped apart by this strange phenomenon on the surface of Mars. 20 minutes pass and the people on Earth go, oh my God.
And when you say ripped apart, you literally mean you see someone torn limb from limb.
From limb, yeah. And then the space friends, Tim Robbins and Gary Sinise, say we got to go get him, which is very different than trying to go pull somebody, you know, who's like a hostage or someone who's, you know, drowning somewhere. I mean, they actually have to go 100 days later into space. So there's all these multiple nodes of suspense. It's like, will anyone from the first mission to Mars be alive? Will they be reached in time? Will this second mission encounter similar problems or other problems? But also, and I'm not being glib when I say this, it's a movie about the emotions of its characters. These are all people who really want to do something. They have a great desire to explore, and some of them pay for that desire, and you know, others are driven by it in a somewhat heroic way. It's a kind of Hawksian movie about professionalism and camaraderie and sort of sacrifice. It is.
And featuring Jerry O'Connell.
Featuring Jerry O'Connell, who's there as, I guess, a sop to the kids. You know,
I love Jerry O'Connell. He's one of those people who shows up and I know I'm going to smile. I'm okay with
but,
that.
But, you know, the mission to Mars gets in trouble before they get to Mars. And then mm-hmm. once on Mars, minus one member of their mission, which we'll talk about later, you know, they encounter what can sort of only be described as, you know, a Kubrickian reckoning with the infinite, but expressed very, very differently than 2001. Expressed not just through images, but through languages. And actually, it gets more Spielbergian than Kubrickian by the end.
I was going to say, it's more AI.
Yeah, I was saying Close Encounters,
yeah. You know, yeah. By the end. And because this is Brian De Palma, who started out as the American Godard and then became a Hitchcock appropriationist, when the movie came out, everyone says, because I recognize these trace elements of these other movies in the film, it must be a ripoff or bad. Instead of looking at the different ways that it uses that iconography, it weighs very different than those original filmmakers. There's definitely some of Kubrick in Mission to Mars, but it's mm-hmm. about very different things than 2001 is about, I think.
And this is a film that, while in North America, was kind of universally panned by critics and didn't do well at the box office, so it wasn't as dismal as Red Planet.
No.
The French loved it. So like Cahiers du Cinéma put it as their number four film of the year, which of course makes sense because they are early adopters of Brian De Palma's greatness. But to me, that was reading that going into this film, and I did see this film when it came out in 2000. I just don't remember much. Put a really interesting kind of twist on it, the idea that this is an auteurist, like you're saying, Adam, and also a film that, you know, if the French like it, it must be classy, right?
Well, and there's a famous review from an American, from the inimitable and I think quite estimable Armin White, who's, you know, a really formidable critical presence in between being kind of nuts. And he threw the gauntlet down pretty hard for this movie. And it's a very quotable line. He says that anyone who doesn't like Mission to Mars does not enjoy movies, much less understand them. And what I love about the quote is that it's absolutely in contrast to the dismal critical reception that the movie got. The kind of Kubrick rolling in his grave dismissal that, you know, this movie is someone else's leftovers. I believe it is very possible to like and enjoy and understand movies without liking Mission to Mars, but I am more sympathetic to that statement than I am to the one-star reviews of the film by people being hacky and lazy.
Agreed.
Let's get into the idea that, because De Palma is considered an auteur, if you subscribe to the auteur theory. Now, what do you see in him, with everyone talking about this leftover, warmed over? What should people be looking for that is De Palma that stands out to you?
His movies are always about people who fail to save the people they love. And technology can't save you, although he's interested in technology whizzes and geeks. You think of The Kid in Dress to Kill, you know, you think of, he has all these characters who are always interested in technology and surveillance and in gadgets. And, you know, here they get to play with them on a huge scale. And it still doesn't quite save the one or I guess couple of characters who pass away. But this movie is not as swamped by failure as De Palma's movies often are. I think he's the greatest filmmaker of failure in the history of American cinema. They fail always to save people in his movies, and that happens here. But you also see characters follow their principles into a very heroic realm. There's a very beautiful line in the script. It's a cheesy line, and it's not a soft pedal line. It's a heavy-handed line about, you know, life reaches out for life. And when you think about that line in terms of reaching out and not quite saving someone, and then the moments of reaching out and actually reaching them and pulling them back. The movie plays with both of those things. And in both areas, both the failure and the success, it kind of applauds the effort. This is an unconventionally sentimental movie for De Palma, not because he's unemotional. I think that's the biggest bullshit about him that people have, that there aren't feelings in his movies. There are. But here the feelings are actually quite sweet. And typically with him, they're not. You know, typically it just ends in tragedy and sadness. And here there's real excitement and optimism about finding something new in the universe.
And a sustainable marriage. Like, that makes it a rare case for De Palma where there isn't a marriage that's based on, you know, psychological terrorism or fetishistic obsession. It really is just a nice married couple are in space and have to deal with the fact that each are expendable, essentially.
What are we, a married couple? Would it kill you to invite me out on the dance floor just once?
We danced at our wedding. We danced.
No, that's not dancing, Woody. That's you shuffling your feet around while you grab my butt.
But if I may point out, that makes them bad astronauts, as you see, because she almost puts the mission completely in jeopardy. And this would be an argument I'm sure a lot of people would make for putting married couples in space, you know, regardless of whether or not you're colonizing with them and doing like a Moonraker style thing. You gotta make sure that these people are psychologically prepared to make those sacrifices, which in this case, it turns out she isn't.
If anyone tries to get you, they'll die too. Honey, please. Go back. Go back and help the others to the surface.
I am not losing you.
Well, there's two moments at the beginning of the film. And again, this is a movie that, and maybe Alicia could speak to this too, if it was based on her viewing of it. Like, this is a movie that has a lot of things in it that are very prosaic and obvious, and from a certain angle seem kind of clunky. I mean, I think that's true. But in the first 10 minutes, you have a child's rocket shot like a real NASA rocket, and you don't realize that it's exploding in confetti until it happens. And you have Gary Sinise looking at a children's sandbox and making a footprint of in that sandbox in lieu of being able to walk on the moon. These are images that speak very eloquently and not accidentally to the idea of this youthful ambition that then gets compromised by adult attachments. And it's because Gary Sinise, through tragedy, is a man without attachments. He has friends and he has people who care about him, and he's willing to die for anybody else, but his wife is gone. He doesn't have a family of his own, unlike the other astronauts who are kids, who have to think about the people they've left behind. That being without attachments lets you go into the unknown. I've always thought it's hugely screwed up at the end of Close Encounters of the Third Kind that Richard Dreyfuss leaves his family.
I was just about to bring this up, and actually Spielberg has said if he were to make that movie today, he wouldn't make the same choice because now he has children and attachments. He never would have met it.
Absolutely, and I don't think that disqualifies Close Encounters. I actually think in the same way that that movie is much scarier than people remember, it really is a 50s sci-fi movie until at the end it's just Woodstock or Burning Man. You know, it's like, hey, the aliens are putting on a light show. But yeah, I mean, he leaves to go into the infinite, and Mission to Mars plays with that idea too, except I would argue in a way, Mission to Mars, it feels more dramatically earned than it does at the end of Close Encounters, because by this point in the movie, you understand everything about why Gary Sinise wants to be that guy. And you also understand everything why the other two characters can't be that person, because of what their attachments are and what they've left behind.
May I ask, did you expect the soda pop brand Dr. Pepper to save the day as much as it did in this film?
No, but thinking about the Dr. Pepper M&M branding made me think, as always, that De Palma is taking the piss out of his 70s pals. Yeah. When you watch De Palma, it's all about, there's a long scene in that documentary of Spielberg driving around talking to Brian De Palma on a car phone. Like, these guys were all buddies. So, of course, De Palma is going to be the guy who uses M&Ms to trace the outline of a woman's boobs instead of E.T. eating the Reese's Pieces. Of course he's going to use Dr. Pepper. It's the same feeling you get in E.T. with the Reese's Pieces, which is if it's generic candy, you don't buy it. Branding is how we recognize the 21st century, and he does it in a very irreverent way. I think it's hilarious.
I will say, to his credit as well, and I like the Dr. Pepper stuff, there was actually in the 80s, I guess one of the NASA missions had a test of the effects of soda pop in zero gravity and on the health of the astronauts. So that was like a thing. I don't know if it was Dr. Pepper specifically, but it was certainly something that was being written about in the 80s, was soda pop in space.
Yeah, well, because Soda Pop's the most prefab food in the world, right?
This is a Disney film. It's a Touchstone Pictures. We should say that. It's produced by Disney. And it has the earmark. There's a hidden Mickey. I couldn't spot it, but there is a hidden Mickey Mouse illustration somewhere on the space shuttle that you would have to like really zoom in on. But I do, you know, we have to remind ourselves that this is Touchstone, which was able to do things like rip a man from limb to limb on screen and not get in trouble. But it's very much, you know, a Disney product.
Well, if I can say, just to go into the Disney angle for a minute, because this is actually really interesting. This is one of the first kind of test runs of what the rides theme park movies were going to look like, because Dick Cook, who was the chairman of Walt Disney Studios at the time, was like, we got to start making movies based on theme parks to get people more into the theme parks and get that going and build more kind of rapport that way. And so what they decided to do was they were like, okay, are these going to be direct to video or TV movies, or are they going to be big screen movies? So the first movie they did was Tower of Terror, which was 1997. And it's like Steve Guttenberg and Kirsten Dunst in like a TV style movie. It was actually shot at the Disney MGM studios in their like little thing there. It was technically a working studio. It's the only thing that was ever actually shot there. And then they decided to do Mission to Mars on the big screen and make it for adults. And this didn't do as well as they thought it was going to do. And therefore they actually ended up canceling. They own the rights to John Carter of Mars, and they ended up canceling that project that was meant to be directed by John McTiernan starring Tom Cruise, and then eventually you would get it made, you know, in the disaster form that we now know of with the Taylor Kushner version.
I don't know. And this was also supposed to be directed originally by Gore Verbinski, where De Palma comes on way after this has been developed, when Gore Verbinski, who did Mouse Hunt in 1997, one of my favorite films of all time, you know, he had a lot of clout, but they realized this is too much budget, and he went on to do The Mexican. But he also would end up doing, of course, Lone Ranger, which is kind of in the same vein as John Carter, as these disaster films.
Interestingly, the only millennial Disney movie for a theme park ride that worked was The Straight Story.
Where you
go to Disneyland and you sit on a tractor while very slow rear projection goes behind you, and you think about death. I mean, I just love that you have David Lynch and Brian De Palma in back-to-back years doing Disney movies about death trips, basically.
I mean, what you're bringing up is there should just be a theme park that is rides of David Lynch films and rides of Brian De Palma films.
A Brian De Palma theme park is incredible idea, Alicia.
Well, with the Raising Cane.
I'm gonna email the patent office.
Please
now
put my name on it.
Just
everybody gets a blonde wig as they enter with sunglasses instead of mouse ears. It'll be great.
Oh yeah, no. In the Fury, the destroyed Ferris wheel. I mean, the elevator
right, from Dress to Kill.
The elevator from Dress to Kill. Yeah.
So twisted.
But it is interesting that this is something that he took over, and in the original definition of auteurism, still found a way to get his stuff in there while doing a kind of handed over Disney job for hire, which he would never get again, not just because of this movie, but when Becky mentioned earlier, I mean, when I was rewatching it, I'd forgotten this fact. It is his last big studio movie. Mm-hmm. It's not his last glossy movie, because The Black Dahlia feels like a very
true
built movie, but this was like his last big shot 4 years after Mission Impossible had sort of reopened those doors for him. It's interesting.
Well, the reason for that, he's actually given interviews since, and he said at this point he was just getting note after note after note for executive, and he just got so tired of having to deal with that. And there was a movie, based on one of the horrible college pedophilia scandals that was going to be starring Al Pacino, he was going to do for HBO. And before they even went to the first table read, the executives were already sending him like email after email. And so he just called it quits. He said, we're not doing this. Sandusky, that was it, who it was. He was just like, we're not doing this anymore. And so he just won't work within the system anymore. He says it's so populated with executives and that directors and filmmakers can't breathe anymore.
You love the little bits of spaciousness in this movie that, you know, it's not that like they don't belong in a Disney film, but they're just so unusual for a Hollywood movie of any kind. Like when they listen to Van Halen.
In the long, it's gorgeous long take where they're on gorgeous, like the circular part you can picture from 2001 A Space Odyssey, and the camera's following the Connie Nielsen character. She like does a full 360. This also has an Ennio Morricone score.
Beautiful score.
It isn't. The first half hour is like, this doesn't sound like his music. This is so confusing. And then when it hits, which is all, of course, the kind of suspenseful in space sequences, it hits really hard. And it's an interesting score that I think never gets talked about in his filmography.
Yeah, no, I was thinking about the score while watching it, too. It is a bit of a schizophrenic score.
Oh, like
it keeps changing. But then I love how it's punctuated by pop. I mean, the Van Halen, I mean, no one thinks of Van Halen as being lyrical, right? But when the idea of Dance the Night Away is being literalized by this couple in zero gravity, mm-hmm. and the Tim Robbins character talks about never wanting to take dance lessons, and then space kind of gives him that grace, that then pays off again in the great set piece with very different music where he's floating away, which mm-hmm. you talked about sort of shows them as bad astronauts, but shows them very much as people. And like, when do you let someone go, which is a literal thing in that scene and a figurative thing in that scene. And I find in De Palma's whole compendium of people falling away from people, which happens all, I mean, you think about Carrie as a hand reaching out from the grave. It's always reaching out. It's Angie Dickinson reaching out to Nancy Allen from the elevator. It's Nancy Allen reaching out at the end of Blowout. It's the woman falling off the bridge in Casualties of War. Mm-hmm. And to reverse that by having it be a man and not a woman, and an inversion of chivalry, and even the way that Tim Robbins plays it, because he's not falling fast when this character is falling. It's this slow motion death knell. And even just talking about it, and even given the clunkiness of the surrounding context, it's devastating. I mean, I'm sorry. It's a very moving moment in a Hollywood movie compared to almost anything else from that period that I can think of.
Definitely compared to Red Planet, because those deaths do not get that kind of treatment. And one thing we haven't mentioned is this is actually a Graham Yost screenplay. So he's coming off of Speed and
Twist.
That I kind of find interesting. I see a lot of the action in this film being kind of a tribute to Yost, as knowing how to build action around character development and psychological suspense.
Yeah, definitely psychological. So now one could argue, and maybe Alicia or Becky want to argue this, I mean, when they touch down on the planet and you get bearded Don Cheadle, who's kind of been, living like a castaway
but
in Plato's cave.
Robinson Crusoe would be a better novel for them to be reading rather than Treasure Island. But
there is an extent to which the movie stalls a bit. Mm-hmm. And an extent to which the way that it tries to visualize the infinite, you'll notice he gives you Kubrick's monolith, except instead of just a black rectangle, you can actually go into it. Mm-hmm. And then it's just a planetarium show, which explains all the things that Kubrick's movie doesn't explain. My 4-year-old inexplicably is now drawn to 2001 these days.
I thought you were going to say you watched this with Leah, and I was like, don't put that on this podcast.
No. But my 4-year-old, because of my parents, ended up looking at parts of 2001, and now she draws me pictures of Hal and daisies.
That's so creepy.
Oh my God.
Oh my God. We are literally looking at a picture of this listener.
But anyway,
it's very cute.
That's my point. My point is that we've been looking at 2001 lately, and the whole point of the last 20 or 30 minutes of that movie is the connectivity between the images you're seeing is left for you. There is a big amount of explaining at the end of Mission to Mars. And I think that that's kind of where people found the opening to take their shots at the movie, to say this movie is very literal. On the other hand, you could sort of say this is just a different kind of movie. It's aiming for a kind of coherence and message that doesn't make it better or worse than 2001. It's just different.
It's definitely not asking its audience to take acid or LSD and head to a movie theater the way that 2001 kind of opened the doors for.
I think these kind of movies are intended to invite you to ask the question, if I were in this position, what would the choice I would make be? Because, I mean, it's something similar as we talked about earlier in Close Encounters of the Third Kind. Would I get on the plane? In this case, he makes the choice where, like, Gary Sinise does have friends and people who love him, but he is missing that concept of actual exploration. It takes a major tragedy for him to be able to actually live his dream. And who knows what he's headed towards? We have this idea that these creatures are benevolent and they are technically our creators, but we don't actually know who they are or what they want or if they're just going to bring him in and turn him into a zoo, right? You don't, or just dissect him or make him something else. You never actually know what's going to happen. And I think the thing I liked about the movie is that it invites you to kind of have those, would I make the same decision if that was the case? If I was watching my partner go, but I knew that I would sacrifice the mission for this one person, would I, you know, would I make that same choice? And I think this movie is really good at asking you to put yourself in that position and ask those questions for yourself.
How rare is it for a Hollywood movie to earn not one, but two happy endings side by side? Because it's a double happy ending for the characters who need
double
to,
rainbow.
Double rainbow. It is double rainbow. For the characters who need to be back, they're allowed to be. And for the guy who looks at the sandbox and sees his footprint and is like, I want to put my footprint somewhere else, he gets to. And it's funny because if De Palma has some of the funniest the end credits I have ever seen in movies. Like if you've seen Passion, it has the funniest the end of any movie ever made.
I love Passion so much. That is like my favorite, one of my favorite De Palmas.
I mean, if you remember the end, the way it just jumps on screen. I mean, here there is a very abrupt the end.
Yeah.
I just interpret it as a director who's saying, yep, we actually have closure. I have brought this film to a place of dramatic coherence and the rest is kind of left up to you. It's not a very chin-strokey ending. It's pretty definitive.
Yeah.
Allegedly there is a alternate ending. Allegedly. De Palma says this was written, but it was never filmed. But some people claim there's an Easter egg where this actually exists on a DVD that it was shot, where the capsule actually hits the like escaping thing that he's doing and the two of them explode in a giant blaze of fire. So nobody survives. There is that an alleged alternative ending, but De Palma has said that it was never shot. It was just part of an original idea in the script.
It sounds like him joking around.
Well, joking around or being like, I have also made those movies before. Because you don't get a bleaker string of endings than Carrie, Dress to Kill, Blow It. And I think that's why, even though it has elements of him in it, it is also somewhat atypical. Like, I was screwing around writing about this movie on Letterboxd the other night for fun, and I was like, a movie about competent, talented people who care about each other, directed by Checks Notes Brian De Palma, right? I mean, it is sort of somewhat odd. I guess I'm very susceptible to the good feeling in this movie because it for some reason, as kind of not cheesy, like as kind of earnest as it is, it doesn't feel dumb, you know?
Yeah, it's true. And I think maybe coming back to Red Planet, it's because the special effects, which are partially ILM, Industrial Light and Magic, are very good. The production design is beautiful. They're basing a lot of the Martian kind of sculptures, not just on 2001, but on Brancusi's, Constantin Brancusi's, like symmetrical, beautiful facial sculptures. This has bite. This actually has thought out, you know, design and thought out. It's not just so committed to authenticity and science the way that Red Planet was that it doesn't look good.
Yeah, that's a really good point for sure. Especially the architecture that you're talking about is quite gorgeous.
Yeah. Ebert, I think, reviewed this kind of negatively, although not as negatively as Red Planet. And he was attracted to that sculpture, this Martian face that you see on Mars that happens like really, I think, 30 or 40 minutes into the film, if not earlier. And he wanted that to be the climax. And that's kind of interesting because I think it's really bold of De Palma not to make that the climax. That's just part of the first act. And then everything that comes after it is the explanation for why that face is there, because that's not what most directors would have done.
Yeah, we do get a slightly unfortunate, like, benevolent, smiling Spielberg alien.
Oof, that alien doesn't work for me.
I like that it's a she. I think it's a she. Mm-hmm. But she's not great.
Yeah, she's a little bit like, to use another Simpsons reference, Mr. Burns in the X-Files episode where he's like, I have a piece, and he's the alien.
But this is also a reference, if we just get back to the face for a second, it's a reference to the 1976 photo of the surface of Mars that was captured by the Viking 1 mission, which everyone was like, it looks like a face, and it does, when you look at it, look like a face. Speaking of X-Files episodes, they did a whole episode about this haunting astronaut's dreams, but it's just like a side view of like a particular type of crater that when you look at it one way, way you see a face.
It actually reminds me of AI, which I know is after. But for me, I'm a huge fan of AI, but I like to turn it off at a certain point, and then it's a perfect film. And I feel like that there's maybe a tiny argument to that with Mission to Mars. Not necessarily that it needs to be turned off at a certain point, but if you could maybe make your own cutout of the alien that you would like to see and then just kind of hold it up to the screen and move it around so you don't have to look at this very Disney-nified creature, it might help the film a little bit.
Well, the same moment an AI lands like a haymaker with the blue fairy underwater,
yeah,
and you have this theme park attraction.
Which I love.
I love, and which can't, by definition, do anything for him because she's just a religious icon. He's invested her with meaning. And that is, and then when you think about the fact that the narration says he looks at her for 2,000 years, then you see Spielberg operating in this actual Kubrick realm of like, I'm not saying anything, but it's saying a ton.
Yeah.
About the faith we put in religion and sculpture and icons and how we imbue meaning on these things that can't actually do something for us.
That's where I hit stop on my VCR.
The alien at the end of Mission to Mars is actually like, I'm smiling at you because I can actually kind of give you what you want, little mm-hmm. human. And it's a little hackneyed, mm-hmm. right?
I think that's fair, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, Red Planet does little bugs that'll burrow into your brain and make your head explode. Mission to Mars does happy time alien, I can save the planet.
And we haven't even mentioned the most mutilated space travel movie from this period of them all, which could be a subject of a future podcast, which
space
is Walter
Cowboys?
Hill's.
Oh no!
No, Walter Hill's Supernova.
Yeah.
Film so mangled that Francis Ford Coppola actually volunteered. He's like, I can fix this.
What year is Supernova? Not 2000, is it?
Isn't it? I think it's 2000. Somewhere around there. Maybe I have it wrong. A movie that also did not do well.
God, it is 2000, yeah. Right?
But which is held up in a way a bit like Mission to Mars is, as like the compromised vision of an old school auteur, as opposed to what you got with Anthony Hoffman, which is just like the guy didn't quite know what he was in for.
What's crazy about this podcast episode is I knew we wanted to do Mission to Mars. And then it was a question of what 9 or 10 films can we pair with it. And I vaguely remember thinking about Supernova. But it's interesting because you also have, I was making a joke earlier, but like Space Cowboys with Clint Eastwood. And
sure.
Like there's like just the amount of space films in the year 2000 is remarkable.
Space Cowboys makes a very progressive point, which is that we should celebrate old white guys in the 21st century the way we did in the 20th. You know, they haven't left.
Especially the crankier they are and the least helpful, you should celebrate them more.
I quite like Space Cowboys.
Yeah.
And Clint, if you're listening, just don't ever die, okay?
All right. I think that is the perfect place to leave it as we're discussing old white men who make their own movies exactly the way they want to make them. So, Alicia Fletcher, thank you so much for joining us once again.
Thank you, Becky. I already have like a million new ideas for next season for weird space movies. This could be a whole season of a podcast on its own.
I'm sure that as you've just given someone an excellent idea, it's going to be on iTunes before we can even imagine it. And Adam Naiman, thank you so much for joining us.
It was an absolute pleasure. Thank you.
Now, how can people find you and your multitudes of work?
I write film for The Ringer. You can pick up issues of CinemaScope, which Alicia is also often in. I have a couple books out now that'll be pertinent this fall. We have new films coming from Joel Coen and Paul Thomas Anderson, and I have books on both of those dudes. And I completed the Male Formalist trilogy with an upcoming book on David Fincher, who's a very obscure filmmaker.
Our listeners will not have heard of him. He does a lot
of Coyote
cinema likes David Fincher.
Yeah, very, very, very little written about his films. I'm hoping that this book is going to do that thing where you light a candle instead of cursing the art. You know, and if maybe just one more person as a result sees Gone Girl.
Or 7. I mean, I've always felt 7 was very underrepresented.
Alien 3. Alien 3 is my personal favorite.
Alien 3. Yep. Yeah, so that's what you can, that's where you can find me. And thank you again for having me.
And of course, you're someone who's always on A Year in Film, the television version. So that's coming up with season 3 in December. And you can watch season 2 now.
Yeah, they make sure to cut around the parts where I just descend into maniacal laughter about the movies Alicia asks me to talk about. Those are some of the most fun times I have ever had.
Your take on Howard the Duck definitely built the segment.
echoes through the ages. But thank you guys.
An absolute pleasure. And you can join us next week where we look at two millennial takes on monsters. And we're joined by Will Sloan and Justin DeClue of the Important Cinema Club podcast. It's Godzilla 2000 and Dracula 2000. That's coming up next week. Thanks for joining us for this episode of the A Year in Film podcast on Hollywood Suite. If you enjoyed the show, please remember to rate and review us on your podcast platform. Want to email the podcast? You can do so at podcast@hollywoodsuite.ca. Find us on Facebook, Instagram, Twitter, at Hollywood Suite. Hollywood Suite is the home of the movies that shaped the 70s, 80s, 90s, and 2000s. Always uncut and always commercial-free, Hollywood Suite lets you experience movies the way they were meant to be seen on 4 HD channels and Hollywood Suite on demand. Subscribe today at hollywoodsuite.ca. The A Year in Film podcast is hosted by Becky Shrimpton and produced by Becky Shrimpton, Alicia Fletcher, and Cam Maitland. Today's guests were Alicia Fletcher and Adam Naiman. Supervising producer is Ryan Mains. Executive producers are David Kynes and Julie Kumaria. Creative consultant is Emily Gagne. Audio engineering by Andy Reid. We'll see you next time.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.